This is a war between the government and the Tamil people.
I'm not a fucking terrorist. You are the terrorist.
People are crying out for justice in this country.
If you've got to be militant to achieve your aims and your aspirations, so be it.
There's a real hypocrisy from the big corporations.
The people from below will push for real change.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
Welcome to the Indie Media Show on RTR FM 92.1. My name is Raymond Grenfell, joining you until 12 noon. Brahma is also in the studio, but before we get any further, a huge thank you to Jeff for another excellent edition of On The Record. It's always such a pleasure starting your On The Record weekly dose with Jeff on a Monday morning. But of course, you can get On The Record every weekday here at RTRFM from 9 in the AM. As I said, this is the Indie Media Show. That's all the news, interviews and views from the open publishing wires of the interwebs. And on today's show, we're going to be chatting about a convention that's about to take place over in Brisbane. It's the Land Forces 21 convention that will run from the 1st to 3rd of June at the Brisbane Convention Centre in South Brisbane. It's, by its title, Land Forces, you might not know what exactly it's about, but essentially it's all the major weapons companies from around the world alongside the Australian Defence Force representatives and defence ministers, as well as trade delegations from over 70 nations who are gathering in Brisbane to try and to sell their wares, to sell their new technological killing machines. A bunch of people, though, are gathering to oppose this convention, and the arms dealers getting together. There's the Disrupt Land Forces Festival that's taking place, where people have been already taking action to try and disrupt some of the military-industrial complex activities. And a little later in the show, we're going to be speaking to one of the organisers from Disrupt Land Forces to find out about what's going on over in Brisbane. We're also going to be talking about a historic court victory. The Australian Federal Court has ruled that Environment Minister Susan Ley has a legal duty not to cause harm to young people, the young people of Australia, by exacerbating climate change when approving new coal, gas and oil mining projects. We're going to be speaking to one of the group of eight young people who brought the case to the federal court a little later about that court victory and what it might mean for, I guess, action in regard to the climate change, and particularly when considering the expansion of projects such as gas and oil here in Western Australia, whether this victory will have any impact or create any potential roadblocks for these projects. And speaking about gas projects, we're also going to be chatting to the Director of the Conservation Council of Western Australia, Piers Versteegen, as the here in WA, the Scarborough Gas Project is another step closer to receiving financing and getting approval. The massive project in the state's northwest is a joint project between Woodside and BHP, will potentially be one of the largest polluters in Australia, almost the equivalent, it's estimated, to the Adani coal mine. So the Conservation Council and a bunch of other groups are trying to put pressure on the state government and also on Woodside and BHP shareholders and others to at least put in a proper environmental assessment of this project. Now, the anti-war movement has been quiet of late. Perhaps some of you were involved in the anti-war demonstrations back in the early 2000s. There was a time in which there seemed to be ongoing activity in regards to opposing war and the military-industrial complex. However, right now in Brisbane, there has been somewhat of a resurgence of activity with peace activists, environmentalists and others who are opposed to the ongoing wars and militarized world that we seem to be living in. They're all gathering together to disrupt Land Forces in Brisbane at the moment. Land Forces 21 is a convention that is taking place at the Brisbane Convention Centre from the 1st to 3rd of June, seeing all the major arms dealers and manufacturers manufacturers from around the world, plus our own defense force and ministers, gathering in one place to sell their wares and to talk about how they can better militarize the world. As I said, a bunch of people, peace activists and others, have gathered to oppose the Land Forces Convention. And I had the opportunity to speak to Margaret, who's an organizer for Disrupt Land Forces, a little earlier today. And I simply started by asking Margaret exactly what Land Forces is.
It's a massive arms dealers expo, and there's about $30 billion on offer by the Australian government over the, you know, per year for the next 10 years. And this conference is about arms dealers in Australia, including some large transnationals who have set up here, building partnerships and trying to figure out ways they can get a piece of that pie. It's like a huge amount of money that's being spent, and these companies are all teaming up to sort of find new partnerships, to find new ways of organising so they can, so that they can enter into the supply chains of the global arms weapons industry.
I guess for many of our...
It's just land gear. So it's for gear that's being sold into armies and police forces. It's the sort of gear, some of it is the sort of gear that you see being used on the streets of Colombia at the moment, or in the highlands of West Papua. You've got attack helicopters by Boeing. You've got tanks and armoured vehicles, weaponised armoured vehicles. You've got all sorts of surveillance drones, weaponised drones. Then you've got a lot of kit. You've got the sort of munitions that they're firing at protests in Myanmar, sort of munitions they've got they're firing in Colombia. And then you've got, different types of vehicles that move people around. So it's all based on land, not sea or air.
Certainly. Now, I was going to say that I guess a lot of our listeners would be aware of, the huge demonstrations in regard to the invasion of Iraq in the beginning of the early 2000s. Many of us participated in those demonstrations. However, in the last couple of decades, it seems as though the direct connection between Australia and these wars around the world is definitely, it's not as clear cut anymore. And I think that perhaps one thing that this convention demonstrates is that there are ways in which the Australian government and our corporations are actually participating in conflict and war. Is that one of the, I guess, the reasons for the protest, to try and highlight how both the Australian government and some of our Australian corporations participate in some of these ongoing occupations and wars?
Well, we think the corporations are in the offices of the government, telling the government what to do and setting up the agenda of the government, organising the government policy. The Pentagon officials are in the Defence Department running the Pentagon agenda, and the Pentagon agenda is to sell as much of their weaponry from the US into the global supply chains as they can. They have four fake justifications for the military industry. One is security, but we know from Clinton Fernandez's work on the WikiLeaks cables that they never talk about security. The Americans and Australians, when they talk, it's always about trade. It's about how they maintain their own domination on the financial sector, on the domination on their brands and on what they sell. So what we know is that corporations, just like the fossil fuel corporations have been well shown to be in the Prime Minister's office, these corporations are in the ministers' offices and the industry offices. So the industry ministers' offices. So each of the states have an industry minister, minister for industries or creative innovation, something like that. But really what these people are military industry operatives pushing the agenda of the large corporations. So you've got eight large corporations operating in Australia with special status, what they call global supply chain program status. And so it's these companies that are now, the government's now dependent on to roll out its own sort of supposed defence project. And I say defence with, little air quotes, because it's really not about defence, as we know. It's really about selling, maintaining conflicts. And really, the people they get used on are First Nations people, people's movements, resistance, democracy resistance movements, these are the people who bear the brunt of these weapons. And they get used to enforce extraction. These weapons get used on the, wherever there's extraction, they're used to stop any resistance to extraction. So this industry goes hand in hand with the fossil fuels movement industry. And it goes hand in hand in such a way that the money flows from the fossil fuel industry into the government and then out into the military industry. So basically they pay for those industries to defend them for further fossil fuels exploitation.
Now, you mentioned the fossil fuels, and obviously the catastrophic climate change is an ongoing issue. And there are so many issues, as you've also mentioned, that are interlinked into the military-industrial complex, such as refugees and also just the ongoing repression of democracy movements and so forth. I imagine there's a coalition of groups that have come together to take part in this festival of resistance. Can you speak to that a little bit and some of the diversity of the groups and the individuals that are involved? Is it a really broad church, so to speak, in terms of those people that are taking part in the demonstrations?
Yeah, so we've reached out as widely as we can, and we certainly have refugee people, who work so hard to free the people from the refugee, the hotel refugees. We're working with them. We have queer people and women's, people from the women's movement, the old women's peace movement. We are making a strong standing against toxic masculinity because we see that toxic masculinity is playing out in this industry. Really, the toxic masculinity is, it's really driven by war. It's heightened by war, and it's heightened by these men having to be perpetually ready to kill. And we think that there's a strong alliance there to be made for those movements that are trying to stop the arms trade. We have West Papuan speaking, First Nations, West Papuan, Aboriginal people. We've tried to centre the Aboriginal story too. We like to centre the frontier wars in any story about militarism in this country. And we are honouring the fact that Australians just cannot think about militarism because we lied about and been so silent about the frontier wars. And yet we see these frontier wars playing out right now in West Papua in the same sort of format, but with modern industrial weapons, Boeing attack helicopters, Thalers, Bushmasters and ammunition, Rheinmetall, armoured vehicles, machine guns from Russia. So we see this playing out where you've got First Nations people trying to defend their forests and their lands and their lifestyles, their cultures, their children. And they are being terrorised, and this is enabled by armoured vehicles being able to drive right up to their villages and unleash large battalions of people to terrorise people. So we think there's two things going on here: both the crazy sort of arms race just for money, and the second thing is the sort of enforcement using violence against First Nations peoples.
Margaret, it seems sort of strangely that Queensland is pretty much the place to be in terms of arms dealers and military exercises. And of course, you've got the Talisman Sabre exercise activities planning to occur later in the year in Queensland at the ADF Townsville training area. This has been an ongoing sort of joint exercises that have been taking place in Queensland for years and are often met with resistance and protests. You do have this sort of week of protest planned, this festival of resistance, but are you hoping that this will build momentum to try and oppose the Talisman Sabre exercises coming up? And more broadly, are you hoping that it will sort of help to reinvigorate, I guess, the anti-war and peace movements, not just in Queensland, but in Australia as well?
Well, we're trying to build a strategy. Like, that's in a way, that's a different issue. That's about the militarisation of Indigenous lands. And in a way, that movement has to be led by Indigenous people. It's Indigenous lands that are being overtaken in Northern Territory, huge tracts of lands in Queensland. I'm sure there's some in Western Australia as well. So strategically, that's a different movement. And I have been involved in that movement before, but I'm not looking at that movement. At the moment, I'm looking at the burgeoning of the weapons industry. It's really out of control. And I think I think the cities are the place to be at the moment. And, though, of course, I've been at Solwater Bay for 10 years on and off. I think at the moment what we need to do is try and build a strategy. And what we're looking to do is build a strategy that's based on... with West Papua at its centre and the sales of arms to Indonesia at its centre, because that's what's rolling out right now, and they're the people that are being harmed directly. We're at a point where the war in Afghanistan is finishing, supposedly, but the weapons companies will be trying to make that war keep on going. Certainly what we want is the young activists in the climate movement to understand that militarism is going to be aimed at them, that if we don't get a handle on militarism and the sale of weapons, then we don't... any gains that they make will be peeled back by the use of militarism against them, because that's where militarism comes at. It comes at people's movements. It comes at First Nations people defending their land. It comes at democracy movements and union movements. And this is where the violence gets aimed at, and this is where the violence has always been. And so at the moment, that's what we're trying to look at. We're trying to look at which companies are involved here. And we've got Boeing, we've got Thales, we've got Rheinmetall, and we're looking at the corporations, because we've seen that targeting corporations in the climate movement has been very successful. And we've seen with the Stop Adani campaign a very strategic way of thinking about how you target non-violent action at corporations. And we think that if we can find the right target, maybe it's Boeing, and that we all need to stop using Boeing aircraft, because Boeing actually makes aircraft for war crimes. It doesn't actually make many civilian aircraft anymore. Civilian aircraft have been, very problematic. And so, maybe that's the target. Maybe we take an Australian target like NIA, which is building ammunition and looking to sell that into export markets. Maybe we look at Thales, which is building the submarines in Adelaide, and is already under pressure from the government for not meeting its outcomes. Or maybe we look at a company like the Perth company, Austal, which is building patrol boats that don't meet the standards but still gets the money for the tenders. I don't know. I think we all need to look at our local communities. Like right now, we're right this minute driving past Thales. It's in the neighbourhood I basically grew up in, and where these arms factories are popping up across the country, not just in Queensland. Western Australia has a huge arms industry. You've got Kim Beazley, who's the godfather of the entire sort of sector. And so... he will be moving at the moment in his position as governor, opening arms contract to arms contract. And so I think this is where we need to look. Where $30 billion a year, if we can't, we need to peel that back, that $30 billion. And I think we do that by going after the companies.
That was Margaret Pistorius, who is an organiser with Disrupt Land Forces. You can find out more about their actions that are coming up over the next week at disruptlandforces.org.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
Now, the Australian Federal Court has ruled that the Environment Minister, Susan Ley, has a legal duty not to cause harm to young people of Australia by exacerbating climate change when approving coal, oil and gas mining projects. The decision that came in the Federal Court in Melbourne last Thursday comes following a case brought by a group of 8 young people on behalf of all young Australians that was filed in September last year. The group of eight young Australians argued duty of care existed and also applied for an injunction to be granted to stop the minister from approving Whitehaven's extension to its Vickery coal mine in New South Wales. One of those eight young people was Western Australian Bella Burgmeister, and I had the opportunity to speak to Bella yesterday, and I started just by asking Bella exactly how this court case first came to be. Bella, in a world first, the Federal Court of Australia has found that the Environment Minister, Susan Ley, has a duty of care to protect young people from the climate crisis. In this judgment that has been hailed by lawyers and many activists as very much a world first and a great win for the climate justice movement, can you start by telling us a bit about the background to this case? How did it come about? And I guess, you know, what was the, I guess, your personal motivation for being involved?
Yeah, so I guess the case kind of started when I got asked through the school strike movement how I'd like to be a part of it. And then from there, we had meetings with the lawyers who are super great. And, you know, we had discussions with them and they talked to my family and my parents about what would be happening. So it was all really, really well informed so I could make a decision around it. And then, you know, from there we had meetings on a regular basis where the lawyers would explain to us what was happening. We did media training because this is obviously a very big deal because we're Australia first, obviously. So it was really good. Every step of the process, we were all very informed about what was happening. It was such a great experience.
Now, specifically, this case had sought an injunction to prevent the minister from approving a proposal by Whitehaven Coal to expand the Vickery coal mine in northern New South Wales. I guess specifically in regard to that project, does that mean now that the project itself will be delayed or will not be approved? Can you just tell us about the, I guess, the specific sort of details around that in terms of what effect will this have on the Whitehaven Coal project?
Yep, so the injunction that we asked for was a special kind of injunction, which wasn't granted, obviously, but we are still in the process now of making more submissions about, because we already know that she has a duty of care, so we're now talking about how this duty of care will be affected if she approves this mine. So it's still possible this mine won't go ahead. We still have time to add submissions. I think it is till the 3rd of June until the judge said we have, until our submissions are due.
Right, so I guess in a sense, this sort of the decision by the federal court is in some ways a symbolic victory, but it will help to aid in these campaigns. Obviously, one of the big sort of campaigns at the moment is the ongoing campaign against the Adani's coal mine in the Galilee Basin, but there's obviously this huge expansion of coal throughout both Queensland, New South Wales, and of course here in WA, we have this gas-led recovery. Do you think that this court case will set a precedent, though, that when it comes to these sorts of the expansion of these projects or these new projects, that this will create perhaps a new roadblock for climate activists in terms of stopping these kind of projects?
Yeah, I definitely think so. This case is a building case, and we already know that the court ruled that the minister has a duty to take responsible care for these actions. They're causing children harm because of climate change. So, if you know, we can use that argument over and over again, and that was our main point with this case.
Indeed. Now, I guess if you look at, I guess, our sort of our federal and our state politics, unfortunately, there is this continuing reliance on the fossil fuel industry here in Western Australia. We have the state government very much pushing, as I mentioned, for this gas-led recovery. And while, of course, yep, federally, I'm sure yourself and many others would like to see, and you know, the end of the coalition government, it very much seems that, unfortunately, both major political parties are still backing coal, backing gas, and backing fossil fuels. I think, you know, in a way, this court case demonstrates a need for diversity of tactics and the fact that, you know, using the courts can be effective in creating some change or at least creating, as we said, some roadblocks. You're also a part of School Strike for Climate and, of course, engaging in sort of strikes and forms of civil disobedience and so forth. What has this experience taught you in terms of that need for diversity of tactics and for using courts and other means beyond just, I guess, going to the polling booths every few years?
Yep, Well, you know, there is no hope without action, and, you know, I'm always looking for other ways to act, and this legal case is just another way of doing that. And it's really good because, as you said, there's so many different ways we have to take action now. We have to come up with different tactics and things. And just going through our legal system is another way of doing that. And it's a very effective one because, you know, we're using the law to prove our point and to make our voices heard and to stop these dangerous mines from being put in.
And I guess talking about those legal cases, you said also sort of a building case in a way. It is very much an Australian first. Do you foresee there being, I guess, further cases, not just in regard to this particular project, but other projects here in Australia? And do you think more people, particularly young people, are going to be taking this kind of action?
I really hope so. I definitely do. I think it's a great way to take action, especially as young people, as we can't vote. We have to have our voices heard somehow. And through the legal system is just one way of doing that. And, you know, this case, as I said, is a building case, so we may be able to eventually use this argument to, you know, stop all new coal mines from being built in Australia, and that's what we're really hoping for.
Now, I guess just finally, though, many people, particularly young people, might not necessarily have access to the resources or, I guess, even know where to begin in regard to sort of taking this kind of action, but there are many things people can do. And as I mentioned, you are a part of Student Strike for Climate. There was recently a strike around a national strike here in Perth. There was people taking action, not last Friday, the Friday before, I believe. I guess, can you just tell listeners a bit more about what's planned in terms of Student Strike for Climate and how, I guess, young people and their supporters can get involved and participate in that movement?
Yep, so our next big strike will be in October, which will coincide with the UN meeting that's happening. That's an international strike, which is going to be super exciting. We're also going to be working with other environmental groups like Extinction Rebellion and things like that, so we're all going to be striking on the same day. And, yeah, it's going to be super exciting, and as an adult supporter, we know we just need you to show up and show your support, really, and you know, invite your friends to come along, because the more people that are there, the more our voices will get heard and our message will be spread out. So that's what we're really hoping for.
You mentioned there that groups such as Extinction Rebellion and so forth are taking part in that. And I guess there's this sort of this idea of these strikes that you want them to be as big as possible, but there's also the element that they are a strike and, in a sense, a form of direct action or civil disobedience. How important is that element of the movement, that it's not just about rallying in a traditional sense? I mean, I think many of our listeners and many people would have been to protest rallies and so forth, and sometimes there's this feeling that you go to a rally, you walk around the block, you go home, and nothing much changes. But it seems with Student Strike for Climate, yeah, there's this element of, you know, I guess, you know, the strike for a start, like an act of civil disobedience and withdrawing, you know, yourself from school or from work to participate in this action.
Yep.
How important is that in this movement?
Yeah, so, you know, we take a non-violent direct action form of approach in school strikes, so making sure that, and it's so important because it just gives our voices out there. As I said, we can't vote yet, so we need to show our politicians what we think about these major decisions that are being made. And the more young people that we have standing with us, the bigger our voices get, and the more change we'll be able to make and the more impact we'll have. So it's definitely about coming along, bringing your friends, and, you know, just sharing your voice, because, you know, it's standing up and fighting back. That's what we're doing.
You're listening to the Indie Media Podcast, first broadcast on RTRFM 92.1.
And you're on the Indie Media Show on RTRFM 92.1. Just before, we were talking about the school strike for climate movement, speaking to Bella Bergmeister. Now, one issue here in WA that's greatly affecting the ongoing issue of climate change or catastrophic climate change, and perhaps our government's inability to take action on that, is the ongoing expansion of our gas industry. Indeed, the McGowan government is very much pushing for a gas-led recovery to the COVID-19 pandemic. As a part of that, there is a proposed expansion of the Burrup gas hub. And one of the major projects as a part of that is Woodside and BHP's massive Scarborough LNG project that's been in somewhat legal limbo for a while, but is unfortunately getting ongoing support from our state government here. The Conservation Council of Western Australia have launched a new campaign to at least try and get a proper independent environmental assessment of the Scarborough project. And a little earlier today, I spoke to the director of CCWA, Piers Versteegen, and I started by asking Piers exactly what the Scarborough gas project was and why it was of such grave concern for Conservation Council of Western Australia.
Yeah, so the Scarborough project is part of Woodside's Burrup Hub expansion, which is a massive LNG expansion on the Pilbara coast, on the Burrup there. It involves bringing on two very large offshore gas fields, including the Scarborough field and the Browse Basin field, which is much further north off the Kimberley coast. And also onshore gas from projects like the Waitsia project, which has been approved in the Midwest. And that gas would be processed through expanded facilities on the Burrup Peninsula for export as LNG. And that would enable those facilities to continue operating till well beyond 2050. So we're talking about very large expansions in West Australia's fossil fuel production. Australia has already overtaken Qatar recently as the world's largest gas exporter in the form of LNG, which is an extremely pollution-intensive way of getting gas to the market. And these projects would further extend that. But what we're particularly concerned about is the carbon footprint and the impacts on Aboriginal heritage that would occur as a result of this gas processing. And also there's really significant impacts on our marine environment because they need to do seismic testing, drilling to get the gas out of these subsea deposits, lay new pipelines and really do a lot of dredging and dumping of dredge spoil and really considerable impacts on the marine environment. So what we're concerned about right now is that BHP and Woodside are pressing ahead for final investment decision on the Scarborough part of this project. That's $16 billion just by itself. And remarkably, the carbon footprint, the environmental impact of the greenhouse gas emissions, and also the impact on the Murujuga rock art, which is proposed for World Heritage listing, hasn't actually been assessed by the EPA. There's been no environmental assessment of these impacts. And late last year, we commenced legal proceedings in the Supreme Court of Western Australia to challenge those environmental approvals that have been given because the state environmental legislation requires that environmental impact assessment does occur. And that court process is still ongoing. It probably won't be resolved for many, many months because Woodside are dragging that out. But in the meantime, it looks like the state government, and in particular the Environment Minister, the Honourable Amber Jade Sanderson, are getting ready to make further approval decisions to allow the Scarborough project to proceed, despite the fact that it hasn't had environmental assessment and despite the fact that there's still this legal challenge hanging over the project.
Certainly. Now, this comes as the International Energy Agency found that a narrow and extremely challenging pathway to net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050 is ahead. For this attempt to reach net zero greenhouse emissions would mean that economies such as Australia would have to have zero emissions electricity grid by 2035. So it comes as, you know, there's mounting pressure on governments around the world to really cut oil, gas and coal. Of course, as you're mentioning here, and the West Australian state government are really pushing for this gas-led recovery in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic. But I guess, as you know, for people like ourselves, there's just increasing evidence to suggest that we need to be cutting fossil fuels. And yet it seems both at a federal and a state level, despite any hyperbole, both major parties are still pushing ahead with fossil fuel expansion, particularly gas here in WA. Why is it, do you think, that both our state government and our federal governments are just ignoring reports such as this International Energy Agency report and others telling them to cut fossil fuel expansion and instead are doing the very opposite?
Well, we know from a long history that both our state governments and our Commonwealth government are essentially captured by the fossil fuel industry, whether it's the gas industry now or the coal industry in the past. You know, these industries are very good at influencing government through their political donations and other campaigns and other things that they do. And so we've got a situation where our governments really aren't acting in the best interests of Australians or Western Australians. Instead, they're acting in the commercial interests of these companies. But what's happening here with the Scarborough development is, you know, this is really a last-ditch attempt to further expand fossil fuel extraction here in Western Australia. You've pointed out that, you know, there's a global shift occurring, and that shift is accelerating. Most of our trading partners now have committed to net zero by 2050. None of them have mentioned a huge role for LNG in that or an expanding role for LNG. So Woodside's really betting their house, essentially, which is the entire value of the company, on an expanding LNG market, which would enable these projects to be profitable. And it's very doubtful that that's actually going to occur. So the economics of these projects are becoming increasingly marginal, but they're desperate to get them off the ground just now before it becomes so clear that they just won't be able to go ahead. The Scarborough project by itself, it's been a bit difficult to estimate because of the fact that it hasn't gone through environmental impact assessment, but we've run our own numbers on this and had them checked by various experts. That Scarborough project by itself would release 1.6 billion tonnes of carbon pollution. It's really astonishing, actually. That is more than the Adani coal mine, and it's equivalent to about 15 coal-fired power stations running every year. Most of that emissions comes from the combustion of gas when it's sent overseas, but a really substantial amount also happens here in Western Australia, and it would continue to push up our greenhouse emissions in our state. When we actually need to be getting them to come down. And under this government, this state government, this is really the opportunity that we have to stabilise the growth in Western Australia's emissions and to start getting those cuts and to start getting us trending down. And there's a huge positive story about the opportunities that doing that would create for jobs and investment in a whole lot of clean industries that can actually take over from fossil fuels in terms of providing jobs and economic development. So there is a really positive story, but this is the last-ditch attempt by Woodside. Woodside as a company have failed to really look into alternatives other than fossil fuels and gas production. So it's sort of a bit of a do-or-die situation for Woodside, which is a very risky situation for their shareholders and investors. But that's what the company is planning to go ahead with at this point.
And just finally, Piers, I mean, here in Western Australia, there is very little political opposition given the huge mandate that the McGowan government was delivered at the last election. I imagine, of course, CCWA will be trying to put pressure on Labor members and ministers in order to try and, I guess, turn the tide in regard to the huge support that this government is giving to gas expansion. However, I imagine there are other points, I guess, of pressure that can be applied both within the corporate sector and in the public sector itself. What can people do and where will this campaign be applying that sort of political and sort of social pressure in terms of ensuring that this project doesn't go ahead?
Well, firstly, part of the McGowan government's mandate is to do the right thing in the public interest and in the interest of our long-term future, rather than act in the interests of big corporations. And that is something that the state government has the power to do. They have control of both houses of parliament. They're in an incredibly powerful position, and they can use that power to do the right thing and actually start to get our greenhouse gas emissions down. That is what the Labor Party is committed to in their policy platform, and that is what we expect the new Minister for Climate Change to be doing in her role. So it's really reckless, actually, that the government would even consider giving further approvals to a project like this with more emissions than the Adani coal mine and, of course, really significant impact on Aboriginal heritage without any environmental impact assessment. So we're saying that they need to slow down. They need to, at the very minimum, not make any further approval decisions until these projects are subject to full proper environmental impact assessment. We believe if that is done, it will show that the projects are unacceptable and shouldn't proceed. And just in the last few weeks, there's been thousands of people that have been calling the minister's office. They've been absolutely inundated with phone calls. People have been sending emails and sending messages to the minister and to their local members. People can go onto the Conservation Council's social media, the Facebook and Twitter, and link onto those actions. They can call the minister's office. So that's really important that we do that and that we express deep concern about these issues. Many scientists and other organisations are doing the same. But really, ultimately, I think this is going to come down to decisions by shareholders and investors. And that's why, you know, we're focusing a lot of effort now on engaging with the potential investors for these sorts of projects to demonstrate the risks that these projects would have. And it's not just Woodside, it's also BHP. And people need to be aware that, you know, BHP is a company that promotes itself as a responsible company that's taking action on climate change. But at the same time, it's supporting and investing these projects that have, you know, greater pollution than the Adani coal mine with no environmental impact assessment and a catastrophic impact on the global climate and just completely unaligned with the Paris Agreement, undermining international action. That is what BHP and Woodside are doing now. So the community needs to be aware of that, and we need to bring that pressure onto these companies directly and their investors and shareholders as well.
That was Piers Versteegen, who is the Director of the Conservation Council of Western Australia. And that's about all we have time for on the Indie Media Show this week. Of course, we'll be back next week at 11 a.m. In the meantime, you can always restream the program at rtrfm.com.au, or you can listen to our individual interviews via our SoundCloud, or get in touch with us either via the corporate social media or via the offices here at RTRFM. Keep a lock though, as after the news, Rhiann Todd-Hunter is going to be taking you out to lunch, all of your new music needs for a Monday afternoon. And as I said, we'll be back next week at 11 a.m. But as we say every week on the Indie Media Show, don't hate the media, become the media.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?